You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we want to hear from you about your best vacation ever, whether it was in Wisconsin or on the other side of the world. First, it's been a year since Boston stores and Yonkers closed their doors in Wisconsin and the region. The department store's parent company, Bon-Ton Incorporated, declared bankruptcy in 2018 and liquidated all products from its stores before permanently closing. But how have shoppers reacted to the closures, and where do they go now? Our next guest interviewed former Bon-Ton shoppers and community groups about the impact the closures had on their lives. Paul Gores is a business reporter from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, talk about, before we get into the impact of the closure, talk about the Bon-Ton presence here in Wisconsin between the various stores and the headquarters.
Yeah, Bon-Ton's had a big presence in Wisconsin for a long time, going way back to the Boston store, right around the turn of the century. We've had a Boston store in the Milwaukee area, but it grew into a major mall anchor at actually, we counted up about 26 malls in Wisconsin here. So it's always been a really big presence here.
You, in your piece, tried to dig into whether people felt a void left by the closure of all these stores. Let's start with shoppers. You talked to some shoppers who, it sounds like, did actually miss their Boston store or other outlet.
Yeah, I wasn't really sure what I'd find because you hear some people lament that they're no longer here, but a lot of younger people weren't going there anyway. So I talked to some experts, some retail analysts, and some shoppers just to see if I could get a take from them. And I found actually that there seems like there are a good number of people. And I thought it might be all baby boomers who grew up with the Bon-Ton stores who would miss it the most, and maybe they do, but it seems like there were also some younger people, some Gen X folks in that group, too, of missing Bon-Ton.
And there were some places where people had to change the way they shopped. Sounds like even drive a lot further to get the products they used to get at a Yonkers or a Boston store.
Yeah, I talked to one woman up in West Bend who had a Boston store very nearby, and she said now to get some of the cosmetics and perfumes and things like that that she likes, she has to drive to Mayfair Mall in Wauwatosa, which is about 20 miles away for her.
That said, you mentioned you talked to some retail experts. At least some of them didn't feel like there was a big void left by the closure of these stores. There was other retail to fill in the gap. They didn't feel like it had a big impact on retail, it sounds like.
Yeah, it sounds to me like there wasn't a lot of looking back to try to gauge what went wrong or what happened. People had just, in their minds, it seemed like people had just moved on and found other places to go get things, or maybe not, or just kind of give up on shopping for certain brands that that Bon-Ton stores carried.
Now, you also dug into an angle that I hadn't really thought of, the role of this chain of stores as, I guess, a local corporate citizen, and there were people in the Milwaukee area in particular who did miss that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. They were really a good corporate citizen here for a long time. They had an event twice a year where you could bring in, for example, you could bring in used clothing, and in exchange for that, you got coupons for to buy new things in the store. That generated a lot of secondhand items that Goodwill stores could sell, but a lot of times people would also do cash donations along with that. So that's missed by Goodwill. There were a Civic Player, United Way, things like that. It was a big employer here, so that has just suddenly vanished from the scene.
Talking to Paul Gores from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, looking at about a year after the closure of Bon-Ton stores, including places like Boston Store and Yonkers, the void that's left behind. One of those voids, Paul, is a physical one, places that they used to fill in malls and shopping centers. What's happening there?
Yeah, that's where it's most noticeable. You drive to a place like Brookfield Square or Mayfair, and you've got this giant space, two stories in most instances, I think three at Mayfair, that's just unused and waiting for its next life. At those two places I just mentioned, right now there's nothing set publicly at least, for reuse of that space. They're talking about reusing space at Southridge for a workout athletic facility, and it's also part of a. They're talking about tearing down the old Boston store and redeveloping it at Bayshore Mall. But yeah, it's kind of if you're walking in a mall and that space used to be a hub of activity, it is just there's nothing there now.
Now, take us back to the why of the story. What led to Bon-Ton and its various retail outlets going bankrupt?
Yeah, well, it really kind of boils down to debt. You know, if you and I don't make our monthly payments on our mortgage, the bank, after a pretty short amount of time, is going to say you can't pay your debts back. We're going to have to take your house. And that's kind of what happened with Bon-Ton. They borrowed a lot of money as they expanded in the early 2000s, had $1 billion of debt, and when the time came repay the debt, they couldn't do it. So the creditors basically wanted them to go bankrupt and liquidate, because they felt like that was the only way they were going to get their money back. And they sort of forced them into it in the bankruptcy procedure that began in early 2018.
Was
and then it took?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and then it took until last August then to wind down with going out of business sales.
Was competition from other outlets part of the story here? The Targets and Walmarts for physical space, Amazon for people shopping online.
Yeah, well, and that ties into the debt thing. Their sales kept dropping year after year. They hadn't really made money since 2010. That was the last time they posted a profit. And a part of that was just increasing competition from online retailers. And part of it was just them not, from what experts tell me, them not really keeping up with the times. They were kind of slow to get a website up and running. They did, the more they cut back on service in their stores, the fewer people wanted to go there and shop. So it was everything just kind of piled up on them and worked against them from continuing. The other thing that kind of comes into play is for department stores in general is that, one time they were the one-stop place that you could go to get everything you needed just about. Over the years, other retailers have come up and kind of taken whole departments, like Ulta Beauty, for example, took over cosmetics and business, and that used to be something that you could find only in some of the department stores. So you had that kind of competition going on, too. Just a lot of competitors cut into sales, and they didn't generate enough money to be able to pay their debt.
So we've lost Bon-Ton. Shopko, of course, is now just going into the optical business. The stores are done. We hear trouble at JCPenney and Sears. At least one of the experts you talked to said, hey, this might just be the life cycle of the brand. They rise and then they fall.
Yeah, I think that's true. And if you've lived long enough, you've seen this happen over and over again. You know, remember Sports Authority, not all that long ago, really. Kresge's, Woolworth's, dime stores that were big and popular when many baby boomers were kids. They just get merged out of business or go out of business because times change and people like new and better things. And now, of course, we have online sales, which are huge.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Paul Gores is a business reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the legacy of the Bon-Ton store chains like Yonkers and Boston Store after the company declared bankruptcy last year. Coming up, it's August vacation season, summer vacation season anyway, is just about over, and we want to hear from you about your best vacation ever, the best place you ever went, whether it's close to home or far away, and what made it so memorable. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Your calls and stories coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, House Democrats are keeping up their calls for the Senate to pass a bill expanding background checks for gun sales. We'll find out how President Trump and Senate leadership are responding. First, as summer is starting to wind down, we found ourselves reliving great vacations we've had, some recent, some years ago, some here in Wisconsin, some far away. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What's the best place you've ever gone on vacation? What's the most memorable vacation you've ever taken? What made it so special? What stands out about the experience? If you tried to recreate it, did it work? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. This could be near or far. We asked around WPR. A lot of our coworkers are happy to share their memories. Aubrey Ralph, WPR radio operations manager, says, "We like to go to the Dells the day after it closes. It's a ghost town and it's wonderful." And Al Ross from Spectrum West, WPR's regional show in Eau Claire, says, "Some of my most memorable vacation destinations were staying put. No driving, flying, or running around, just sitting, vegging, reading, or noticing things that daily trips in the fast lane missed. The key is to look at the clock periodically. It makes the time go even more slowly. That's the key to a restful vacation." Well, some of our colleagues went further than that, too. But how about you? 800-642-1234 is the number to share your best vacation ever. 800-642-1234. Jana Rose Slice from The Morning Show says, "I had the honor of visiting," this is a little further away than nowhere, "visiting the Great Barrier Reef." She says, "I studied abroad in Australia and actually went snorkeling in the reef twice. The colors of the fish and their underwater habitats were gorgeous." Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John starts us off in Shawano. John, hi.
Oh, I'm on the air already.
You sure are. Where'd you go?
Yeah, good day, guys. Vieques, little island off 9 miles or so off the southeastern side of Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there 3 times before and after the hurricane, Hurricane Maria I'm talking about. A year and a half ago I was there 4 or 5 months after the hurricane, and people were running off of generators, and still just fantastic people. Beautiful beaches and just the wonderful people is what I'm talking about. Besides beautiful beaches.
Gotcha, John. So it's the people is a big part of it for you, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. The only people that had power were the ones that had generators going.
All right, John. Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Asking you to share your best vacation experience ever as the summer season winds down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Lee with us in Hartford. Lee, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What story did you want to share with us, Lee?
About 3 years ago, I took a bike ride from the Milwaukee area, actually from Hartford, up to Minocqua.
Ooh.
And I took county roads and bicycle trails, and I was by myself, and I just really enjoyed the solitude and the beauty, and it was just a wonderful vacation. It was just a wonderful trip. It took me a few days to do it, but that was okay. I didn't hurry or anything. I just took my time, and the bicycle trails were just great. So it was wonderful.
That sounds fantastic. Lee, would you do that again, or maybe come up with a new route, another bike trip like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I would do it again. Or, we have so many wonderful bike trails, I would surely take some more bike trails and do it that way.
Fantastic, Lee. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Ron is with us next in Wausau. Ron, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Thanks for having me here. Back in the 60s, I did something that no longer exists. I got on the U.S. 66 downtown in Chicago, and I drove it all the way to the end at Santa Monica Pier in California.
Wow. Now, and I got to ask, Ron, did you get any kicks along the way on Route 66?
A lot of them. A lot of them. And most of those kicks on US 66 were the places along it and then taking side trips. It was wonderful.
Do you have a favorite side trip that you took or a favorite spot along the way?
No, I've gone back and forth many times. One of the neatest things was there used to be a grapevine coming into Albuquerque from the east side, or since I live in Wausau, I better say Albuquerque. coming in from the east side, it was a long downhill grapevine, and you could just see all over the state from it. And it was great. It was one of my best memories.
Ron, thank you so much for sharing that. We're asking for your vacation memories, your best vacation ever, whether it was close to home, across the country, or across the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We asked around our colleagues. Rob Mentzer, our WPR Rural Communities reporter, says he went to Iceland in 2016. He swam in hot springs, toured an abandoned herring factory. Abandoned herring factory. I mean, that's the key to any good vacation. And hiked at the collision point between two continental shelves. Beautiful place and great yogurt, Rob says. Back to your calls now. We've got Ella with us in Madison. Ella, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Ella?
Well, this past spring, I just finished up my second semester at UW-Madison, and I had the very fortune to be able to study abroad in London as my home base, which was a great city to start off with. But I had the chance to go to a lot of different countries, see a lot of different things, meet lots of different people. But I would say that out of my time over there, I was able to go to Stockholm, which was a pretty, pretty special city for me. I have lots of Swedish heritage. My grandparents, great-grandparents came over from Sweden. And so it was just really cool to be able to connect with my roots and see the beautiful country and the beautiful city of Stockholm. I mean, I was there late February, so it was snowing. Still beautiful, though. Worth it in the cold. And the people there are great. I just felt so happy when I was there the whole time. So lots of great experiences, but definitely one that stuck out to me, I would say.
Ella, I assume I know the answer to this, but would you want to go back to Stockholm and maybe spend some more time there?
Oh, absolutely. I hope that I get to go back with my dad sometime, too. He's the one. He's been to Stockholm before, but I'd like to be able to go with him and, you know, get to enjoy the kind of special experience between both of us. So,
Ella, thank you so much for sharing that story. We're taking your stories of great vacations, maybe your favorite vacation close to home, at home for that matter, or around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. John joins us next in Stevens Point. John, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, John?
Well, I had an opportunity to go to France and make a parachute jump on the 75th anniversary of D-Day,
wow,
on one of the original drop zones. And it was, when I made the jump, it was 3 days past my 75th birthday.
No kidding. Wow. Okay, and that's an experience. And then thinking,
it was awesome.
But did it make you think about the history of people landing and jumping near there on that anniversary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We walked the beaches of Utah Beach, and we seen the German bunkers along the shoreline that had some pretty good pockmarks in them where they were hit by the shells from the ships. We went through a lot of the museums, and St. Mary Glees has got an airborne museum there, and tells a lot of the stories that you never hear in your, and you never read about in your history books. But it was, the boys didn't have an easy time of it over there.
No.
Either the guys that jumped in or the guys that hit the beach.
John, I got to ask, you were 75. Was this your first time jumping out of a plane, or is this something you'd done before?
Well, I was 82nd Airborne in the service.
Oh, okay.
I jumped two in Vietnam, and I got a chance to go through an abbreviated jump school down in Texas with a Liberty jump team, and which qualified me to get on the manifest to make the jump to Normandy.
Wow. John, thank you so much. What a great story to share. I appreciate that. At 800-642-1234. Gail joins us next in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. This brings back such wonderful memories. I went to Hawaii, to the island of Kauai, and I knew that they had horseback riding there, so I took my riding chaps and my riding boots with me, and while I was at the stable riding, this rancher shows up and he sees I've got my chaps on and riding boots. I'm dressed to ride. And he comes up and he goes, tomorrow I'm going to go round up some cattle. He goes, so you come back and you're going to go out with me for the time of your life. And I was out in the middle of this beautiful area on Kauai, cutting cattle, riding this amazing cattle horse. That is like my ultimate memory of any vacation I have ever been on.
Amazing. Cattle ranching in Hawaii. I don't think a lot of people have that on their vacation list, Gail.
Because I brought my chaps and my boots. You never know.
You thought ahead, Gail. Thank you so much. That is great. Back to your calls. We've got Kathy with us in Ephraim. Kathy, hi.
Hi, this is Kathy, and I just think that the treasure of Wisconsin is Door County. Ooh. I know a lot of, it's just, I've been able to get, I live in Chicago now, I'm in Ephraim having my vacation before I go back to work, and I just can't say enough for all it offers, you know, from the natural beauty to the boating, to the theater that they have up here, to the, you know, art and everything, and then the ice cream.
Thank you so much, Kathy. That's a great Wisconsin example there. Time for another call or two. Diane is with us in Watertown. Diane, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say our favorite vacation was Anaheim, California, for a meet and greet with some minor celebrities that my son is still friends with. But the circumstances were that Make-A-Wish put our family there. And if you've never needed Make-A-Wish, you are blessed. But if you need them and you have someone else arrange it down to the fact that you didn't ever have to stand in line because your child was too sick to stand in line, it's the greatest thing. And I would love to go back there again and revisit some of the Universal Studios and those kind of things.
Diane, thank you so much for sharing that story. Sorry that you needed Make-A-Wish, but I'm glad that valuable experience happened. Thanks to everyone who called. We heard from a lot of our other WPR colleagues, everywhere from Yellowstone to the Mohonk Mountain House in upstate New York. Keep sharing yours. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, a look at the big news in national politics. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, protests are still going on in Hong Kong with fears of Chinese military intervention. We'll find out what's driving the confrontation. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. The Justice Department says it plans to keep investigating co-conspirators of Jeffrey Epstein after his suicide in prison this weekend. President Trump and the Senate Majority Leader are getting calls to expand background checks for gun sales. And the field of Democratic candidates for president spent time this week at the Iowa State Fair shaking hands and eating corn dogs almost 6 months before the state's presidential caucus. Our question for you this week is, how important is it to you that candidates for president show up in your area and put in some face time? What are the events or places you think candidates should be coming to as being down-to-earth a quality you look for in candidates? Have you ever met a presidential candidate or seen him in person? And if you live in Iowa and are listening, what do you think about all the hullabaloo? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Lauren Gambino is a political correspondent for The Guardian. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Lauren, let's start with the reported suicide of financier and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Attorney General William Barr weighed in after it happened on Saturday. Here's some of what he had to say.
Let me assure you that this case will continue on against anyone who was complicit with Epstein. Any co-conspirators should not rest easy. The victims deserve justice, and they will get it.
So what does that mean in terms of ongoing criminal investigations now that the central figure in this case of trafficking is dead?
I mean, it's completely upended the case. You know, he was at the center of it, and much of the focus of this investigation would have been into the crimes that he committed. Now, you know, with his death, they're turning to these what he calls co-conspirators, or the people who are alleged to have helped him, you know, procure or lure these young, you know, teenagers, some of them, to his various properties, you know, for these encounters. It's obviously very grim, but there's a lot of, you know, there's evidence that he had a whole network of people who helped him bring these women to women, girls, you know, to his apartment, to his mansions, to his properties. So I think there's still this hunger for justice for a lot of these women now who've risked a lot to come forward. You know, they've been struggling with the ramifications and the consequences, both emotional and legal, from the fallout. And now that he's no longer able to stand trial, they want to see justice served. And that's why I think you're seeing Attorney General Barr use the full force of his agency to go make sure that they will see justice.
And another focus now for the Justice Department is why this high-profile inmate of a federal prison was able to complete a suicide attempt like this. Questions raised about oversight, about guards and the warden at the prison. Some staff there have been reassigned already while this investigation is going on. What do we know about what the Justice Department is saying about what they're going to be looking at in regards to the death of Epstein itself?
Well, you know, this is a big embarrassment. He was kept at a correctional facility where they, you know, where they're known for keeping notorious criminals. You know, right now, he was one of the most high profile criminals behind bars at the moment. And so I think, you know, now they want to know there's a comprehensive investigation into what exactly went wrong. And details are starting to dribble out. You know, the people in charge that night perhaps this wasn't their jobs. They were reassigned. They were working significant overtime hours. Possibly, you know, they might have signed off to say that they had checked on his cell when they hadn't. So you're learning a lot. One consistent theme that does seem to be coming from these details, most of them are given through anonymous sources because we don't have official accounts yet, but it does seem like the people working, the wardens, the correctional facility officers, they seem to have been very overworked, and that played a role.
Now, this has all given rise to a lot of unsubstantiated theories, conspiracy theories across the political spectrum. What makes this particular case such a lightning rod for this kind of speculation?
Well, a couple of things there. One, I mean, first and foremost, you have the president of the United States retweeting, you know, sort of completely unsubstantiated claim that the Clintons, Bill and Hillary Clinton, might have been involved or somehow played a role in his death. You know, Trump has just said it was just a retweet. I'm not saying that they were or weren't, but I think that kind of speculation from the highest office definitely fans the flames of these conspiracy theories. But I mean, at the core, this was a very high profile case. Epstein was a man who has a lot of powerful connections. Obviously, he had connections to the Clintons, to Donald Trump, to the Prince Andrew in the UK, and plenty of other powerful world leaders. So he was very well connected. And, you know, there's this idea, there was a New York Times story in which he bragged about having a lot of secrets about these powerful men. And so, you know, that's obviously fanned some conspiracy as to how he died.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. Let's turn now a little closer to home here in the Midwest. The Iowa State Fair, it's been running for the last week. Usually that wouldn't be national news, but it's Iowa, so every 4 years it's this huge event, a trial by fried food for any presidential candidate. What are we seeing this year at the Iowa State Fair?
Well, I think in a new record, we learned what a vegan candidate might eat at the Iowa State Fair, and that is a fried peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Cory Booker chose that as his food of choice. So it's been a lot of photos of, you know, very sweaty crowd goers eating all of these fried foods. But I think this year was a little different because it did coincide with these mass shootings. And so you saw candidates try to balance the sort of lighthearted fun that they were having at the fair with forums on gun control and gun violence. And there was kind of this contrast where they would dart from the Iowa State Fair to these forums. There was a couple of them. And so I think that was something interesting this cycle, that, you know, usually it is a completely a fun event, a lot of handshaking, a lot of getting to know the voters. But there was also this very urgent and sort of sad undertone this year. But that being said, of course, the Iowa State Fair is still a great opportunity for these candidates to show off their retail politics, you know, again, shaking hands, standing on the political soapbox, trying to win over these very, very important caucus voters.
This is a unique situation kind of in American politics, this one state, I guess you could maybe throw New Hampshire in, where really being able to connect with a room full of people could theoretically move the needle when actual voting starts in the caucus, right?
Absolutely. I mean, especially with this field, there's so many candidates, and obviously we expect some of them to drop out before Iowa. But even so, you know, if the field remains very large, the pool of people, you know, every person truly could matter. The caucuses are, you know, very sort of unique form of voting. And so it does, you know, you need to hit a 15% or those voters go elsewhere. So really, at the end of the day, you're counting every caucus goer. And so, yes, exactly. When you're at this fair, when you're, you know, eating the pork chop on a stick, which has become the iconic photo op, you are pitching yourself to voters that are, that, you know, could very well launch your campaign, move it forward, or, you know, maybe possibly end it.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian, in our weekly look at news from national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As Democratic political candidates, presidential candidates, lots of them are campaigning, trying to get attention in Iowa. Are you paying attention, or is it too soon to be start thinking about the primary for you? Were you at the Iowa State Fair? Did you see one or more candidates? What did you think? Did anybody make an impression on you for our listeners in Iowa? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're from Iowa or not from Iowa, do you think there's too much attention on our neighbors in Iowa just because it's the first state to start sending delegates? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lauren Gambino of The Guardian, looking at the week's news in national politics. Lauren, we were just talking about Democratic candidates in the Iowa State Fair. There's been some attention on what's going to happen if some of them drop out and some people not running. I want to turn to that now. There's some hope among Democrats that some people currently in the field may get out early and instead run for U.S. Senate in their home states. Who are we talking about there?
We are talking about former Colorado governor John Hickenlooper, possibly to a degree another Colorado senator. We're talking about and possibly the governor of Montana, who has also been talked about for possibly running for a Senate seat there. So there's two candidates who, you know, might not qualify for the third debate. And who are seen as well-positioned to win Senate seats in their state that are seen as, you know, possible Democratic pickups. The Colorado race is interesting. There's already a lot of Democrats lining up to take on Cory Gardner. And then in Montana, you know, there's a lot. If a Democrat's going to win a Senate seat in Montana, they think, you know, someone like the governor Bullock is the right guy to do it because he was reelected governor in 2016, which is obviously the year of the Trump won. And, you know, his state went for Trump by a significant margin. So there's some hope that, you know, if you're not going to go far in this presidential race, why don't, you know, you're still great Democrats. We want to see you get into these other races and maybe help Democrats pick up some seats for the Senate, which is going to be vital if a Democrat wins and has all of these big policy ideas they want to push through.
And a lot of people have been wondering what Stacey Abrams, who had a close run for governor as a Democrat in Georgia, people have been waiting to see what she is going to do, if she's going to run for president. No, looks like. What are we hearing there?
She has effectively ruled that out. She said she's going to focus on a campaign to sort of guard against voter suppression. She's going to really work to engage more voters, get more people registered to vote. That's been her passion for a long time as a politician in Georgia. And now she wants to take that effort national. She'll be focusing on battleground states. So there'll be states in the Midwest, her own state of Georgia, some states in the Southwest. And this is all part of a theory of the case of how Democrats win, which is you need to mobilize some of these voters who don't always turn out very consistently, voters of color and young people especially. So she's going to be focusing on that. So we can the field in theory, the Democratic field should not get much bigger.
And she said no to president, but whoever's the eventual candidate might give her a phone call, she said.
That's exactly it. She did say, call me if you're interested in the VP slot. She said she'd be interested in working, running maybe as a running mate to any of them. So possibly we'll see her on a ticket.
Talking to Lauren Gambino from The Guardian, looking at some of the news in national politics. You mentioned, Lauren, the aftermath of the most recent round of mass shootings. Democrats keeping up the pressure, Democrats in the House keeping up the pressure on Republicans in the Senate to reconvene and take up gun legislation. What are we hearing from House Democrats on the issue?
Yeah, their big challenge right now is really to keep up the pressure with both chambers of Congress being away on recess. You know, they do not want this to fall off the agenda. It's very much on people's minds at the moment. And this happens so often in the wake of these shootings. There's a lot of attention and then it kind of fades. So that's why they're calling for the Senate especially to come back and to debate gun control measures. They really want action on universal background checks. Republicans are naturally, as we've seen in the past, they're a bit reticent. They seem to be kind of forming a consensus around so-called red flag laws, which would allow law enforcement to take guns away from people who are deemed a threat to themselves or others. But I think Democrats are really pushing for sort of a compromise bill that would take in red flag laws plus universal background check. Trump has somewhat offered his, you know, tepid support for background checks. We've seen him go back and forth on this in the past. So, you know, it remains to be seen what he actually does or where he actually falls on this issue. But he's certainly in talks with Senator Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and another Republicans on this issue. And we're seeing Democrats and activists really, really push hard in this moment.
Let's give a listen to President Trump talking here to reporters on Friday about his thoughts on the gun reform issue. Here's a listen.
We need intelligent background checks. Okay, this isn't a question of NRA, Republican or Democrat. I will tell you, I spoke to Mitch McConnell yesterday. He's totally on board.
Is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell totally on board with some kind of expansion of background checks, as far as we know?
I think totally on board is a bit too far. What we're hearing from Mitch McConnell is that he wants to have a debate. He's open to a debate. That doesn't mean he's totally on board with passing background checks. Obviously, some Republicans have already spoken out against them. The NRA remains opposed to them. But I think all of this, especially, you know, the NRA is sort of in a moment of internal turmoil. They're having, you know, a lot of issues internally with leadership and some sort of political crises there. And so I think you're seeing activists really want to seize on this moment and really push when the NRA appears to be in a weakened state. And so that's why they're going full force at these Republicans. You know, if we can show that background checks has, you know, widespread support among the American public, you know, and we allow, if we can at least get the debate going, then, you know, then that's more than we've gotten in the past, especially with Mitch McConnell at the helm, because he, you know, pretty much controls what's coming forward in the Senate. And so they're hopeful that if you can just open that door, they'll be able to push through and get universal background checks. But the idea that McConnell is totally 100% on board, I think, is probably overstated.
Even if it does come up for a debate and a vote in the Senate, is it a certainty that we would see the same bill pass in the U.S. Senate, Republican-controlled, as could pass in the Democratic House?
I certainly not. You know, it would have to be it would certainly have to be some form of a compromise bill. I mean, like we were talking about before, you're seeing Republicans sort of coalesce around this idea of red flag legislation, and Democrats are starting to push back saying, we don't want to pass that as a standalone. You need to give us something, you know, probably background checks. So, you know, the Democratic House has passed legislation that they are urging the Senate to pick up. But the Senate's going to want their own version of things, and it certainly won't go as far as what the Democratic House would allow.
On the presidential and, for that matter, congressional politics side of things here, is there concern about from Republicans about suburban districts where this gun issue might be a liability for the president and for Republicans?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at public support for background checks, you know, a lot of the other proposed measures don't have this level of support. Background checks truly does have, you know, broad swath of Americans support them. And that includes Republicans. And the Republicans who do support it are predominantly, you know, in these suburban areas, especially women, which has always been and increasingly is so in the Trump era, a weakness for the Republican Party. You know, this is increasingly a big issue. I've been out on the campaign trail a lot, and you're seeing women, and you see, you know, kids who, you know, their parents identify as independent, and they bring this up. And so I think as this becomes, you know, increasingly a top of mind issue for voters, I think, you know, you're having Republicans, especially from those districts, grapple with the idea of, if we do nothing, what is the political cost? What is the political cost to doing nothing? And so, you know, that might be the sort of breakthrough. Those type of Republicans representing these districts might be the ones that break first.
And finally, in our last couple of minutes, Lauren, in just a few minutes, we're going to be digging into these protests in Hong Kong. I want to take a minute to look at the reaction here in the United States. What have we heard from President Trump in response to these dramatic protests in Hong Kong?
So Trump is, you know, he's taken more of a hands-off approach. You're seeing much stronger reaction from the congressional leaders. He's in the midst of trade negotiations with China, and that seems to be his priority. And so when it comes to these, you know, very dramatic protests, he sort of said things like, you know, I urge calm on both sides, and, you know, the Hong Kong, I think he said it's a very tough situation, but didn't really offer, you know, sort of words to the protesters. That is in stark contrast to what we're seeing from congressional leaders like Mitch McConnell, like Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, like Nancy Pelosi, who are, you know, very strongly offering their support to protesters, you know, fighting for democratic reforms. And I think that's, you know, sort of much more in line with what you traditionally see from American politicians when protesters are sort of pushing for these democratic rights.
And Lauren, just very briefly, in the news today, a big drop in the stock market. Things have been rocky in there. I don't know if people are talking about it that openly, members of Congress and the president. Is this something that's kind of lurking over their shoulders, wondering what is going to happen when the markets open tomorrow and the next day and so on?
I mean, it always is. And, you know, the economy obviously is such both its economy in the short term and the long term. It plays such a significant role in elections. So I think, you know, there is some sort of nervousness behind the scenes about, oh, no, what's going to happen? And, you know, especially as we gear up for the 2020, you know, one of Trump's biggest selling points is the great economy. If that starts to turn sour, if it, you know, turn south, what does he, you know, what does he run on? Does he still have that to point to as, you know, a great achievement? So I think, yes, there's a lot of nervousness about, you know, both what happens tomorrow, but what happens over the long term. And if these trends start to, you know, continue, where that leaves them as they, you know, try to fight to keep the Senate and obviously the presidency in 2020.
Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That's Lauren Gambino, political correspondent at The Guardian. She was with us for our weekly look at the latest news in the world of national politics. Talking earlier about the Iowa State Fair, Democratic candidates going there. If you have been to the fair, if you're maybe one of our Iowa listeners, you've met candidates, I'd love to hear from you just what the experience is like and what fried food you ate. Email us ideas@WPR.org. Here is the big news story of the day. It's actually news about the word, the, T-H-E. Ohio State University, full official name, The Ohio State University, is trying to trademark the word, the. Don't worry, even if they're successful, you and I can still use the word, the, in print and speech. Their idea is to trademark the word, the, I think in all capitals, for use as a logo on jerseys, hats, and other sportswear. So you could have a hat that just said the on it, and everyone would know it was short for The Ohio State University. Well, as reported in The Washington Post, some trademark experts are skeptical that they'll get this approved. Fun bonus fact, Ohio State once tried to trademark OSU as a logo. They ran into some pushback from Oklahoma State University. We'll go out with some music from a potential plaintiff if lawsuits come out of this. It's the song Infected. From 1986, it's by The. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.